Welcome to the Modern. My name is Erin Starr-White, Director of Education for Docent Programs. I'm really glad you're here. I'm going to read this because there's quite a bit to cover. On the calendar for next month, just to put this out there, November 4th, we have art historian and TCU art history professor Mark Thistlewaite. He'll be speaking about special issues in the exhibition for our 10th anniversary celebration, so it's not to be missed. This afternoon, we're really privileged to have Matthew Bourbon here to speak about the Lucian Freud exhibition. Of course, Freud closes the end of this month on the 28th, so this will be the last last Sundays with the Modern to hear an artist speak about his work. Matthew attended the School of Visual Arts in New York City. He received his Master of Fine Arts there in 1999. He earned a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Fine Arts from UC Davis in California, both in 1993. He's Associate Professor of Arts at the University of North Texas, where he began teaching in 2000. Matthew's also a prolific writer and has contributed art criticism to publications such as Art News, Art Forum Online, Flash Art International, and Glass Tire. As you may have heard, Matthew's astute on-air reviews on North Texas' own KERA, where he has covered several exhibitions that were here at the Modern, including William Kentridge, Five Themes, and Kara Walker, My Compliment, My Enemy, My Oppressor, My Love. Matthew has shown extensively in solo and group exhibitions in New York, Dallas, Houston, London, Italy, and the United Arab Emirates. He was a Huntington Art Prize finalist in 2010 and was nominated for the Art House of the Jones Center Texas Prize that same year. He's given lectures at the Kimball Art Museum, the McKinney Avenue Contemporary in Dallas, Dart Gallery in Houston, and various universities. And his work has been written about critically in art publications such as the Dallas Observer, New York Arts Magazine, Modern Luxury, Glass Tire, and Might Be Good. And as I think you'll agree, Matthew's insight into the portraiture of Lucian Freud is supported by his really dynamic engagement with all myriad forms of contemporary art. Please join me in welcoming Matthew Bourbon.
That's all slightly embarrassing to stand there when somebody does that, but thank you very much. I just want to thank Erin for inviting me to do this. It's always fun for me to come in and talk about a show. The last show I talked about actually was the Warhol exhibition, and I find it enriching for me as an artist because I get to reevaluate maybe some preconceived ideas that I have about a particular artist or what I've come to know of them over the course of my time thinking about them and looking at their work. And sometimes you put artists on shelves and you sort of have your sort of received understanding of them and you sort of forget about them for a while. And these shows often provide an opportunity for me to sort of step back and sort of reflect a little bit about what those ideas are and whether I still feel that way about an artist. So it's certainly happened with Warhol, and it's definitely happening with Freud as well. I'm currently also teaching a night class with this exhibition here at the Modern. So it's been interesting for me to come in every week, basically, and at night when nobody's around, I get to kind of come in and look at the work on my own. I told people when we first started that we should get roller skates and do the LA Story thing with Steve Martin where he rolls through the thing. Erin, maybe we shouldn't do that, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. We haven't done it yet, but there is something nice about being able to be with it week after week and reflect upon what you're seeing. So today, I'm not an expert on Freud, not an art historian. I'm just coming at it from the perspective of an artist, and I'll just be talking about certain themes or things that I see in his work that that hopefully will be of interest. So why don't we go ahead and go into the galleries and we'll start. So you have to forgive me, I wrote down some notes, and it's a little cheat sheet for me to sort of jog my memory as we go through. The exhibition is roughly chronologic in the way that it's organized, and so some of the themes that I'll be talking about, they haven't neatly organized them for my benefit. I don't know why. So things we'll have to circle back on ideas because they happen in each room. And we can't just talk about them discreetly in one place and then move on. In thinking about his work, there's I have basically four things that I think creep up for me when I'm thinking of Lucian Freud. The first that is an overarching thing I see in everything that he does, albeit in slightly different fashions, is he has what I think of as a kind of myopic personality as an artist. He's, maybe that's the nice way of saying it, the harsher way is maybe he's a little bit anal in the way that he deals with looking at the world. He portrays or wants to portray everything he sees, and he's obsessive, I think, about doing that. In the early work, it's less apparent in some ways because it's stylized, but if you look at a painting like this painting, it strikes me, although it's incredibly, it shows an incredible facility and skill, it sort of reminds me a little bit of beginning painting students. Students who are not skilled yet, what they tend to do is they want to describe every little thing that they see. So if they're painting a face, they want to look in the eyeball and get every little nuance. If they're going to paint the eyelashes, they're going to paint each individual eyelash. And this is a sort of typical mode that young beginning artists use. And if you look at artists who are more skilled or have more facility or later on in their life, like Sargent or something, you'll see a shorthand that comes in, where they're dealing with creating an image by using a language of difference. So an eyelashes might be just a simple smudge, you know, of the brush instead of indicating each one. There's pluses and minuses to this. I think for Freud, that myopic personality, the desire to portray every little nuance, it creates some of the oddities in his work that I find very unique and interesting. So in a picture like this, if you have the opportunity to come up afterwards or if you've already seen the show and you look closely, he is portraying everything in minute detail. So the fur of the dog is portrayed, you know, each individual hair is sort of like lovingly, you know, marked onto the surface. The fabric of the robe similarly has that quality. If you look at the hair, it's very, very detailed. The eyelashes are individually placed. There's a kind of intense detail of observation that is throughout the work. So this is one theme that I'll sort of kind of come back to as we talk about the rest of the show. The other thing is what I call a cultivated awkwardness. There's an awkwardness in his work, in his best work, I think, that partially comes out of this desire to portray each little segmented thing in as much detail as possibly one can. There's also a slight awkwardness in compositional structures and choices that he's making as an artist of how to organize the picture that I think adds a kind of heightens the quality of his work. So we'll talk a little bit about that. There's narrative in his work, which doesn't get discussed very much. I don't really know why, but anyway, he doesn't discuss it very much from the interviews that I've read, and it's so present in much of the work that it's sort of surprising to me that it's not discussed, that there's this underlying narrative that creeps in different ways through a lot of the work. The last thing that I want to talk about is cruelty. I think there's a bit of cruelty in Freud's work. Maybe on a more lighter note, maybe it's a sinister humor. I don't know. It depends on how you look at it. But I think you'll see in certain works, and from my perspective, I think there's definitely an edge of cruelty that happens sometimes in his work. So we'll talk a little bit about that. The first thing before I get on, I'm just going to read a couple of quotes. I know that's sort of tedious, but I wanted to do that because it sort of frames a little bit about what he's trying to do, I think, and maybe some of the problems inherent therein. So there's just three short quotes, bear with me. These are all directly from him. He says, "After sitting, I like to join as far as possible in the feelings and emotions of my models. In a way, I don't want the picture to come from me, I want it to come from them." So for me, this idea is one aspect of what he does, which is a kind of journalistic approach. I'm just there, just giving you the facts. You know, really there doing the work, I'm kind of just the vessel. Maybe a little disingenuous, I don't know. Maybe I don't think that's the full picture, but he says this. That's one aspect of what he does. He says, "I'm only interested in art that is in some way concerned with truth. I could not care less whether it is abstract or what form it takes." So he's interested in truth, Not sure what that is, what that truth is. That's sort of vague. He doesn't care whether it's abstract or sort of depictive. The last quote is, "The artist who tries to serve nature is only an executive artist. And since the model he so faithfully copies is not going to be hung up next to the picture, since the picture is going to be there on its own, it is of no interest whether it is an accurate copy of the model." So truth for Freud, which is what he says he's after, is not about mimicry. It's not about verisimilitude or making the picture look like exactly like the person. So what is it? I don't know. This is the question.
Sounds like a politician running for president.
There's a lot of vagueness in there, but there's also his desire to reach for something specific. What that is, maybe it's, you know, the sense of flesh, maybe it's about psychology, maybe about, you know, there's other options about what this truth might be, but his desire to get at this thing and reveal it for us is a kind of traditional mode of portraiture, I think. But there's problems because we really don't know what that thing is. Okay, so that's my slightly long preamble. Maybe if we go over to here, we can talk more in more specifics about some things. So I wanted to talk about this painting. It's called Hotel Bedroom. This painting sort of exemplifies some of those themes for me. It has a bit of that myopic sort of anal desire to create lots of detail within the picture. It still has the flatness of the early work. You'll see the work sort of changes as we go on. So it's still thinly painted. It has a kind of flat quality to it. There's a dramatic narrative here that we could certainly interpret and play into. This is a picture of Freud himself, who's sort of in silhouette or in shadow, and, you know, with the woman under the covers with this kind of dramatic pose. There's all kinds of narrative interpretations one can weave around this. There's also notions of power, you know, which will creep up. The model and the artist. There's a long history of artists hiring models, they're in a room, they're usually nude, or you're usually not. You know, you're looking at them intently. There's this dynamic that has sort of fraught with a lot of potential problems and vagaries. And this sort of exemplifies some of that, I think, but on a sort of more sort of story-like narrative way. It's also a bit creepy to me. You know, that sort of silhouette, his expression is not the most loving, you know, genial expression in the world. So I think it's not too far of a reach to sort of take this to a slightly more darker area in terms of the narrative because of the expression he's giving himself. So this is one aspect of that narrative that will kind of recur as we go through the exhibition. Another one, a painting that I wanted to look at, which I was looking at intently, which is a good choice. I mean, I would be doing the same thing. Is this painting called Woman Smiling. And I was telling Aaron earlier, we were sitting having lunch before this, and I was saying when I first came up to this painting, I stood in front of it. I didn't know the name of the painting. I didn't look at the name of the painting. And when I looked at it, I did not see her smiling. I just stood in front of it and I was examining her and I didn't think of the expression at all in any way as a smiling expression. Excuse me. As I stood in front of it and just kept looking at it, the smile kind of appeared to me. And I don't know if that's just because I'm thick and I should have seen it right from the beginning, but I thought that was beautiful. It was kind of an amazing experience for me to sit in front of it, think of it as one way, experience it as one way, and have it change right in front of my eyes. And I think that's part of the subtlety of his approach here in these earlier works, where you see there's a couple along the wall here too, where he's painting very thinly and using his observation to carve out the geometry of the face through these little pieces, these little shards of paint, and layering those to create kind of the volume and the form of the face. And he's sort of finding that image through that sort of process of building. It's almost like sculpting. And I think that process maybe, and I'm speculating here, but maybe is what allowed this painting to have that sort of in-between state where you're not sure exactly, and it sort of engendered that kind of experience I had in front of it where I didn't see it as smiling initially. I also think that this, this also exemplifies some of that awkwardness that we talked about. There'll be an awkwardness in different ways throughout the show. One of them, I think, is the moment in which he decides to portray the model, the sitter. You have sort of more standard paintings, which you'll see where it's more, what I say, it's kind of like posy. You know, they're ready for the pose, and he gives that expression and depicts that expression. And then you have paintings like this where I feel like it's moments in between. It's like the person is posed, cheese, and then they're like going to go do something else, and so their head goes to somewhere else. It's that space between when they're unguarded and not ready. And maybe that's some of the truth he's getting after or trying to seek in the paintings, but I feel like a painting like this really has that sort of awkward moment where we're between something. And maybe that's, again, why I didn't see it directly as a smile right off the bat. It's one of my favorite paintings in the show. I think it's really great. If you have time, I would recommend standing in front of it for a while because it's really great. On this wall over here, we have a really, 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 really bizarre painting, I think. A very strange one. I think this painting is kind of an anomaly in the show. There's maybe three, four paintings in the show that I feel are kind of anomalous to the rest of the show, and I think this is one of them. This is a portrait of him again, and these, I believe, are his grandchildren, who to me look like finger puppets in the corner. I mean, it's very strange. And he's this presence looming over them. So the perspective of this, just the structure of this painting, this composition of the painting, is awkward. Okay. The interpretation that we might make about the painting because of that awkwardness, to me, only adds to the strangeness and the sort of unease of this painting. He's this looming figure. Again, not a really, cheerful expression. Looming over these, over his grandchildren, who are like teeny little finger puppets in the corner, and then he's got these light sources behind him. It's a very odd painting. There's also a weird stylization to this painting. His face is sort of painted more or less like we think of the traditional Freud thing, the brushiness, the back and forth to create the face. But then you get to the suit that he's wearing, and it's really stylized. So it's almost like this is a painting in between. It's almost like it's a little bit of that first room and a little bit of sort of what we see and what we know of as Freud's other rooms. So I find that slightly interesting as a kind of in-between state in this work. But it kind of creeps me out, to be honest. So this one's going to give me nightmares, I think. Okay, so let's go to the other room. So in my thinking about how I'm going to organize this using these themes, I sort of broke this room up into two sections, this sort of the left half and the right half. So starting in the left half, there's two paintings I want to look at, and this was the first one, which is a painting after Watteau, which is, you probably have seen the painting. It's, there's a girl with a guitar, and so it's sort of reference, as an art historical reference in here. Part of what I liked about this painting is I think it also exemplified a kind of awkwardness to it. There was a sort of strange compositional thing that's going on with this painting. In knowing a little bit about this painting, the sitters, I think they posed together at first, but then he spent time with them individually. And his process here is what embeds this painting with a little weirdness. Because he's painted them at different times, and they had them come in, and this person came in, and this person came in at different moments, there were inevitable differences that are built into the painting. It's like it's cobbled together from these different sources, and that cobbling together makes a kind of awkwardness in terms of the composition, a kind of weird stiffness. There's also distortions. If you look at Freud, they often talk about his enormous skill, which he has, right, a kind of abilities to paint in sort of this wonderful way. But there's also lots of weird distortions that happen in his work, if you're paying attention. It's not like he's painting things and giving you this photorealistic thing. The size of people's hands get enormous in relationship to other people. The scale of the kid on the bottom shrinks and gets really small. And to me, these sort of choices that he's making partially come out of that myopic frame of, I'm going to paint what's in front of me. Today I have the kid in front of me, so that's what I'm focusing on, and I do that. I'm not thinking about the whole. He even painted, when he started his paintings, he often would start on the interior of a face and work out, and then just build out from that painting. So it's like he's finishing one section and moving out slowly and slowly and slowly, instead of working all the pieces and thinking about how the whole thing is going to work together in an interaction. So that bit-by-bit process creates anomalies and weirdness within the painting. So I like this painting for that. I think it's also just a beautiful painting. I can get lost in the sort of foliage and the trees. You know, it's just really wonderful to look at. Another thing that we'll see in some of these other paintings is the tilting of the floor. You know, it's this really weird Cezanne-esque kind of like, I'm going to tilt the floor up at you. And he talks about consciously always trying to make the floor different, but a lot of times it's a compositional thing to skew the space up at you, and it pushes everything towards you instead of the depth of the picture plane. I find that pretty interesting as well. I wanted to talk about this painting because, you know, my own work is figurative. It has some narrative qualities to it, but there's a lot of abstraction in my work, and there's a lot of interaction between what's legible and what gets lost through patterning and sort of visual noise within a piece. And so I sometimes find myself looking maybe not at the thing I'm supposed to look at. So I spend a lot of time in this painting and a lot of the other paintings looking at like the backgrounds, the walls, and you know, not the figures. And I mean, I'm looking at the figures too, but I spend time looking at these other things. And I found this sort of ground of this around the man, the wall around him, to be just beautiful. Just really, really beautiful. And different than a lot of the other walls in the paintings that you'll see. There's a thinness that, again, maybe comes out of the earlier stuff. But that's, if you sit in front of this, there's this transparency upon transparency and subtle coloration in there that is really, really elegant. That being said, I also am interested in this strange idea of how he's depicting this guy, right? This is not like the painting next to us where you get the eyes, right? The whole window to the soul and the portrait and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, maybe is nonsense, maybe isn't. I don't know. You can decide. But the insular look of this picture, you know, the interiority of him being down and not giving us the eyes. One of my students in the night class is a retired brain surgeon. The first thing he was like, well, look at the frontal lobe on that guy. You know, he started talking about the frontal lobe. And I'm like, did he mean that? And I'm like, I don't know if he meant it. If that was his, you know, to depict his frontal lobe. But there is this weird, bulbous attention to the forehead, which is interesting because it sort of it builds in that sort of insularity that he's getting with the pose. Also things like, subtle things like the, or not so subtle maybe, like the tie, the bend of the tie, and how that works compositionally with this cutting off of in the corner. There's just lots of little smart chess moves in this piece that I appreciate, that I want to come back and look at and think, oh, great move, you know, like, good job, Lucian. Because it takes, you know, a lot of his work starts at a place that is very traditional and sort of standard, and there are some paintings which I'll talk about that maybe feel slightly less interesting to me because there's certain kind of academic quality to them. It's starting in a place of like, here, there's a model, and I'm just the painter. I'm just going to sit there and paint the model. It's not a lot of bells and whistles and, you know, fireworks. So it's these little decisions that, to me, elevate the work, the good ones, right? The ones that really stand out. They make them more than the sort of the formula that we know, and they make us stop and see it again. It slows us down. We don't just check off the box and go, yeah, okay, that's your standard portrait. It's like, no, we have to see it again because he's doing all these weird things. And to me, that's part of the genius of these really great, the great ones that, you know, you see as we go through the show. Okay, so let's go over there before I ramble too much. So in talking about narrative or the idea of narrative in painting, there's different ways to get at narrative. The idea that we're going to project a certain kind of story onto a painting, we're going to sit as viewer and interpret it in a kind of story-like way versus just the sort of, instead of a reaction to it where it's like the just looking at an object for what it is. It's about things interacting. And I look at a painting like this, and I think this is a way that he gets at narrative. And again, this is just supposition on my part, but I feel like this is a painting where he gets at narrative through, or by default. This is his mother. I believe it's his mother. This is his mother. It looks the same. Portrayed in the chair. It's like almost like I'm going to paint my mom. Here she is. I'm going to paint the mortar and pestle where I maybe mix, my pigment. And then I'm going to paint this woman in the background. It's like he's just doing these things out of time and sticking them together. And he has some sort of automatic weird narrative. I don't know that he was obviously probably conscious that this is going to happen, but I don't know that he was actively going after something like the story in a painting like this. I think it feels to me like it just happened by default, like it's just got put together slowly. Whereas other paintings, which we'll talk about, feel much more conscious to me about what the narrative might be and that he's actively going after that idea of story making. This one, also, talk about oddity. If this woman stood up in the back, she would be like 15 feet tall. I mean, she's so big in relationship to the mother. So, he is aware of these things, right? He's a sophisticated guy. He knows what's going on. But he's making decisions about leaving that, right? I'm going to consciously let this scale get dramatically weird. And, he's a Freud after all. Look at this painting. This is, we got all kinds of stuff we can put in here. But I'll let you do that work. His mother again. I guess he had a relatively contentious, or maybe I should say a distant, detached relationship with his mother. This is the story. And this sort of shows it, I think. I don't know about you, but this looks almost like a death portrait to me. This almost looks like, tombs where they carve the stone death portrait on top, It's a weird pose in and of itself with her arms up, but the sort of blankness of her look and expression has a real detached quality. When I saw this painting, I thought of Monet. I forget whether it's his wife or I think it's his wife, but I can't quite remember the story. Some apocryphal story where he's painting his wife or mother or something on her deathbed, and he gets so enraptured in like the coloration of her cheek and the pallor and the value, and he's just in that moment of trying to get that beautiful, beautiful color on the cheek. Meanwhile, this is his loved one on a deathbed. Right? There's a real detachment in the process of making that separates him from this thing. And this is what I feel about some of Freud, and certainly about this painting, is that there's this weird distance. And, it's maybe an example of what his relationship was with his mother, and so maybe that's brilliant. But it also, because it really says what he wanted it to say as an artist, but it's sort of disturbing to me a little bit, too. So, take that for what it is, I guess. Speaking of dead people, I like looking at this painting. Another really strange one for me. If you haven't noticed, part of what I do as an artist, I'm looking for the oddities. I feel like those are the moments where there's life. It's the place where there's something unexpected. That's the thing where I get jazzed when I'm looking at other people's work. And so, sort of like the mother painting, I look at this painting and I see this guy. He's like sort of lovingly portrayed, like slowly, methodically, sort of articulating the body. He's, working in a different way. The couch that he's on, the background of the wall, again, is really interesting. But look at the expression. This guy feels dead to me. I mean, or comatose or something. There's just a weird, or he's, out of it in some way. There's a weird quality to his face. So he's like displayed for you in all his glory, but then there's like something odd, and that sort of almost delicate way he's painting the body and lovingly way he's painting the body, and that deadness of the face creates a weird friction for me, a weird kind of tension that is off-putting. And then I look at the rat, and the rat is more alive than him. There's a glint in the eye, like the rat, you know, like you can imagine that rat wiggling or something, you know. So he paints the rat more alive than he paints the person. That's a little odd, right? I mean, you know, again, Freudian stuff, I don't know, you know, some therapy in there maybe necessary. But that really is what makes this painting great, I think, is that those tensions that are built into it. And so I think it's really, really brilliant. In this room in general, there's a couple things I wanted to point out in terms of that idea of awkwardness. So sometimes the awkwardness comes, like I said, from that myopic point of view, this sense of I'm painting bit by bit. Sometimes it might be a compositional thing, like the guy with the tie where he's like flattening out the background and his head is down. Sometimes I think he just needs to fit things into the space, and so he does weird things. Granted, everybody's body is different. Everybody has different proportions. Some of our limbs are, you know, like one of my feet is slightly larger than my other one. Everybody has those quirks, right? But when I look at this painting, I'm thinking, wow, that top arm is really short. Like, really short. I don't know about you, but I don't think she had that short of an arm. Maybe she did. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. So why is he doing that? He's doing that because he wants it to fit in, right? He's got to get it. There's a sense of it has to fit in this space in a particular way, and so he does that. There's also just an awkwardness to this pose, the kind of angle and almost tilting and falling over quality to the pose that takes what is, as a subject, a person just in front of you, you painting them, maybe not the most interesting thing to start with, and he makes it terribly interesting, I think, by creating this, it's like a rubber band that's been twisted, right? Each time you twist, it gets tighter and tighter, and it's ready to spring, and then it just steps back and goes, ha-ha, there you go. You know, this is what he's doing here, I think. He's twisting it by making these decisions, and it's just getting that tension inbuilt into a painting, which is really static, a person laying down asleep, really static. But it's not a static painting. And I think that's, again, pretty brilliant. If we just turn around to this, again, really some odd distortions. I'm sure this guy maybe had a smaller torso than the bottom half of his body, but it feels like two people. It feels like if we block out the top part, we got a certain size. We block out the bottom part, we got a smaller size. And so it's like this shrinking happening as he moves up the body. The other obvious thing, the elephant in the room, is that there's a guy's head underneath. Okay, so this is a weird narrative choice too, right? This pushes the painting away from even what's next door of just I'm a figure, I'm a person in a space, and it elevates that painting. It makes the painting, if we took this head out, the one on the floor, and took that out, this would be an entirely different painting. It would do entirely different things. It would function in an entirely different way. By sticking that head in, bam, we've got something else. Now we've got this weird narrative that we have to deal with. I think as people were sort of fixated by mysteries, and just in general, I think as human beings we're fixated by mysteries, but we also want answers, right? And so I think art is really good with mystery. And I think sometimes these little quirks that he puts in are about sort of tweaking the painting towards that sort of mysterious side. Sometimes in another one, which we'll talk about later, he does something similar, and there's a little backstory to it that makes it almost mundane. But it still elevates the painting into this weirdly mysterious place, because we have to figure out, well, why is this guy down here? Why is this guy standing? You know, what's the relationship between these things? And we're left to ponder that question. And I think that's also a real interesting aspect to some of his work. Okay. All right, so let's go back the way we went and then to the left. Or to the right, I should say. just look at the painting as you go by. I'm missing so many great paintings. This is an amazing painting, but I'm not going to talk about it. But it's a great painting, so look at it while you walk by. Actually, let's talk about this one first. I was going to do that one, but let's do this one first. So this, if that painting that we just saw with the woman who was at an angle, that heightens the idea of a figure and sort of just the idea of painting a figure in a room and sort of elevates what's possible in that. Here he does a similar thing in terms of trying to get at more than just a figure in a room by pushing narrative into it. And to me, he does it in a really cheeky way by sticking these eggs here. Okay, so to me, I mean, this is like obvious, like sort of fertility things, but it also sort of mimics the breasts. Okay, so to me, this is a sort of humor that's sort of in his work, and again, a kind of cheekiness that he puts into this. But it, you know, by having that, it changes the painting. It makes it more than just the straight, I'm portraying this person in the space. There's also that weird tilting happening here. So you get that similar kind of off-kilter feel a little bit, which I do think is interesting. Also, this whole thing of tilting the table, I mean, he sort of has it in place, but then he does this sort of like where he's like mixed, you know, wiped his paint or whatever. And so it sort of tilts out at you at the same time. You know, there's all kinds of historical precedent to that kind of thing. And Demoiselle d'Avignon, the Picasso painting, does that. I mean, there's all kinds of painters who sort of like have tilted things, you know, out at you in this way, in odd ways, coming out of Cézanne, I guess. So I think that this is another little chess move like some of the other paintings where he's just adding a little something to kind of give you a little nudge and go, look what I'm doing, you know, aren't I clever? And he is. So there you go. This painting. Probably shouldn't say this because my mother will listen to this podcast and get mad at me. But so my mother saw the show and I wasn't with her, and she's like, "Shaw, I really like the show, but there's some things I just don't like. You know, some things should just be kept behind closed doors. You know, something like this. I forget it what the words were. You know, so don't be mad at me, Mom, when you listen to the podcast. But this, I think, gets to some of the cruelty. Okay. When I look at this painting, first of all, we have the narrative. We talked about narrative in there. Here, sort of narrative by default. Here, I think this is narrative more by design, or more at least going after it in a more direct way. However, I think this painting is incredibly cruel. I think the dog, first of all, is the one who gets the bed. He's in the comfortable position. He's also lovingly portrayed, sort of relaxing thing. So the dog is up there. The woman in the chair, also beautifully played, you know, doing the I don't know, someone said it was cruel, I don't think it was crochet. I forget what the term was. Yes, so I don't know what that is, but, you know, she's doing this handiwork, right, and he makes this really, really beautiful, right, and then he puts her here, in the most uncomfortable position, right? On the ground, sort of exposed, vulnerable in ways that she's, you know, in ways that make us complicit almost in that vulnerability. And she is the most uncomfortable in the whole painting. So there's a weird kind of cruelty in this to me. There's a sinister sort of undercurrent to this painting that is about, at some level, the power to do this as the artist, right? You get to make these choices, and people are willing participants or they're not in terms of models. But the ability to sort of play God is part of the joy of being an artist, but it's where it gets a little dangerous too. And I think that this is a painting where it gets a little bit dark because of that. There's not a lot of sympathy here. The sympathy is more with the dog, which happens a lot in the paintings, but that's a little off-putting. So this will happen in other ways in some of the other paintings. As you look around, you can sort of maybe see some of this. Doesn't mean it's not a great painting. I think it's a great painting. It's an uncomfortable painting, but I think it's it and maybe that's part of his part of what makes him great is the willingness to go everywhere. Say, I'm going to be cruel today. You know, another day I'm going to be something else. And maybe that willingness to sort of be those things is what lets this work go lots of different places and not be too formulaic and boring as it could be. Certainly, it can be reflective of the world. The world is undoubtedly cruel. There's no doubt. I don't think anybody can question that. However, the question is, as the artist, as the maker, do we participate in that cruelty? Do we... there's a line between engaging what cruelty is and maybe adding a little bit to the balance. And these are just questions. I don't know. I don't know the answer. These are just things that come up when I'm seeing something like this.
Is there anything to the possibility that to paint the clothes figure with the blanket on the lap, to paint the dog, to paint the bed, are all things that he knows, whereas maybe painting subtilities, abundance of flesh is something he's getting caught up in?
I think that's a great comment. I think in some ways it goes to that myopic thing. It's like when he's painting the rags or something, they become this inanimate thing that he just gets, and they're beautifully painted, you know, that he just gets enamored with and lost in that moment to just make it, and maybe not step back and see what those implications could be. I also think it's okay. We don't have to be polite and perfect. I think it's okay to be all these different things where people are complicated. They're rich, you know, they're full. So it's okay to have different things. I just think it's interesting as the viewer to sort of think about what those are and then create your own relationship to what how you feel about that, you know. I still think it's a great painting. I also think there's sort of stages of being in the painting, right? She's an older woman, younger, and then you have an animal. So there's sort of like stages of living things in the painting. And that's interesting in its own right. So we could sit in front of this painting all day, but let's keep going. So this painting is one of those paintings which I said earlier was one of the anomalous paintings, like the one where he's looming over his puppet grandchildren. This painting is so bizarre to me. I mean, when I came to this painting, I had seen it before in books and stuff, but I'm still sort of dumbfounded by it. I don't know what to make of it. And it's not just the overt sort of like man-suckling baby, which is sort of like this, it's almost... out of character in its extreme. Just some weird decisions, like the distortions of his legs and the gigantic feet, which I don't think, honestly, are painted sort of up to snuff in relationship to some of the other paintings. There's a weird allowance for distortion and sort of quirkiness in this painting that I feel is very different from almost every other piece in the show, except for one or two exceptions. Still, look at that damn dog. I mean, that is great. I mean, it's great. The dogs he's really good with, right? I mean, the dog is really painted great. But there's such a goofiness about this painting that I can't. It just rubs me the wrong way. And it's not even like that, which is goofy, but. It's just like the way he's there's something about the scale of proportions, right? When you make heads big and bodies small, it reeks of caricature, right? It's that whole thing, and it's possible to make paintings that way and make them great, I think. But it sort of pulls it out. It pulls me out of the moment and into that sense of caricature, and so I'm sort of less present in this painting and more sort of stepping outside of it, looking at it . And so that experience is a little less powerful for me. If we go ahead, yeah?
In so much of his painting, he looks like he's pouring the stuff out of on me, out of the frame. It makes me feel very uncomfortable to have the stuff
He's tilting that floor again, right? Like the floor is like. I don't know the answer, but I think there is something interesting about the dynamic of creating a perceived space within a painting, right? Pictorial depth within a painting, right? It's not an abstraction where everything's on the surface. So creating that depth and then subverting it by having things that are flat. I'm personally quite interested in that, but I think historically artists have been interested in that too, because it does create a kind of tension between the expectations, right? Our expectation is, oh, this is a perceived depth. Look, everything's got to be in its place. But when something's not, it throws you for a loop. When I'm talking to my students, I'm often talking about those moments in paintings. And this is going to be kind of stupid, but there's a cartoon movie called Up. And I don't know who's seen this movie, but there's basically, it's a cartoon comedy, right? And there's this little dog who's running around, and he's got this collar on. I can't even remember the thing, but he sees a squirrel, hears a squirrel, and his ear goes like this, right? And it's like, squirrel, right? I think this is we're kind of like dogs like that. Like when we look at a painting, expectation, 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 we're standing in front of it. When someone does something weird, we go like, whoop, our ear goes up, you know? What's that? That's weird. And it places us again in the painting. We're no longer just numbly taking it in. I mean, there's a degree of numbness to the way we take in work, I think, because we're so familiar with images and painting and everything else. And so when we're stopped at some moment, it forces you back into the act of looking. And I think artists do that by design, to try to get you out of that numbness. So I think, I mean, I don't know if that was his intentions or he's thinking about any of those things, but for me, that's certainly something I think about as an artist, and something I appreciate when he does that in the work. But you're right, it is slightly unsettling because everything is like coming at you. You know? That's true. If we turn around and look at these three portraits on the other wall. So all of these three, I think, are very well done portraits. They're painted really well. I can appreciate them. This is one that I think you liked a lot. But for me, all three of these are slightly more academic. These are paintings, for me, that maybe are not doing that thing where it makes me stop and wonder about some of the decisions. There's a little bit, I mean, he's putting this at an angle. There's some things that he's doing with like the floor and the ground going that way. But there's a little bit of a straight-laced quality to these that, as much as I can admire their skill and facility and all that, they're a little bit less interesting to me because they don't have those moments where something odd is going on or there's a combination of things pulling at each other in different directions. So I just wanted to mention that. I mean, there's so many great paintings in here, but for me and for everybody, inevitably, there's ones that rank higher and or lesser. And for me, those are the reasons why these ones maybe are a little bit less interesting to me. Okay, let's go into the big room.
You know, these weird, like, these slight proportion issues, and your own reminds me of, like, beginning drawing students and how, I don't know, they start out that way, mm-hmm. one section, and then they invested so much time in that great-looking hand,
yep.
they don't want to fix it. Do you think he's doing something like
that? Well, he does work bit by bit, and so it forces you in some ways to have those problems, because you're not thinking, like, this to this, this relationship to this, and so, yeah, I think, I do think so. Okay. So I want to talk about several paintings in this room, two of which are these. He has this thing where, you know, he's sort of known for the body of work we know him best for is sort of bravura painting, pushing the paint around. It's a little bit thick, very painterly. And in some of these sort of later paintings, he builds up this textural surface on the paintings that I find very odd. Sometimes I think it really works to great effect, and it sort of emphasizes the form of a figure or the weight of a body or the sort of the volume of a shape or something. And sometimes I think it works against him. This for me, is a case where it's maybe working against him. I feel like that textural thing got away from him a little bit. It's almost like that myopic thing where I'm going to put texture. You know, it's obsessive a little bit. And I think the texture on her face and elsewhere has a tendency to flatten the painting out, and it just gets quite heavy for me in the face. And so there is a certain pleasure in noting the quirkiness of that, but I feel like in other paintings he's using the texture in a more sophisticated way, where it's saying something about the space, the volume of a figure, or where it is in relationship to the room it's sitting. This one, maybe not so much. I also wanted to look at this painting because I thought it was really interesting. Part of what he does really well, I think, is think about painting as architecture, or the architecture within a painting. So he uses the bodies as an architecture within the painting. He uses the objects within the room as an architecture within the painting. And then he uses the obvious architecture as architecture within the painting. And then he, in this case, because he was unhappy with the scale of the painting, he had a portion of canvas added on. He also is now using the wall as a part of the architecture. So there's all these sort of things playing in on each other. So as her body is moving across this way, the bed is moving across that way, the chair is then moving at an angle that way, he creates the wall on this right side. But by adding this piece mimics and mirrors the wall on this side. So there's, again, a kind of chess maneuvering here that I find is pretty interesting about just how things are situated in a place. It's a compositional thing, right? It's the basic foundation, one of the foundations of painting or drawing. Where am I going to place things? How big are they going to be? Where are they going to be? Situate themselves in space? What angle are they going to be at? All these decisions. And in this one, I think it's a real kind of clear sort of architectural arrangement that I find quite interesting. And the fact that he did add this piece also speaks to something about his myopic attitude, I think. He was not thinking, most artists think, okay, I've got this size canvas, what am I going to do with it? How am I going to fill the space? How do I want it to work? And they strategize at some level. Even if they go instinctually, there's a certain amount of strategizing as you step back from it and interact with what you're making. And he, because he sort of, I think, paints almost like a fresco, bit by bit, moving out. I mean, fresco does it by like a certain section and then moving on, but him maybe sort of an interior place in the body or something and then moving out. Because he paints that way, it's, I think, hard for him to sort of juggle all the compositional things at once. So he may get himself in a situation like this where I really need more space here. And so because he's myopic and dedicated to his vision, he says, now I'm going to do it, damn it. I don't care what it does to the canvas. I'm going to put that in there. I mean, it's an oddity, but I need that space, and so I'm doing it.
As a painter,
We were just talking about that as we were walking between rooms. Some of the distortions that beginning painting students have for drawing the figure in terms of scale and stuff, but also what you're describing in terms of the spaces and stuff, happen because you're in that state of like total attention to one little thing and not thinking in detail, thinking of detail, not thinking of a whole. When you think detail to detail to detail to detail, inevitably there's going to be weird oddities that are inbuilt in that system. If you don't step back and say, okay, wow, this portion is off here, I've got to adjust that to create this relationship here. So I think you're probably right. I think that his natural process of working led to a lot of these irregularities. But he's a sophisticated, he knows what's happening, so it's like, okay, I'm keeping those irregularities. I want that. I'm going to let that exist because that's interesting. Nobody really comes to mind readily. I'm sure there's been other historical, and I know there's historical precedents for people. I mean, you see it when they do documentation of historical paintings where, oh, they've added a bit of canvas here. Or, so I can't place a name right off the top of my head, but yes, it's been done before for sure. Absolutely. Okay, I'd like to turn around and talk about that one on the wall over there. So this painting is maybe the twin to the guy who's standing with the head on the ground, you know, underneath. This time we have the legs. And again, I may be misremembering the story, but essentially I remember it being that the model, he was working the painting without the legs, and it was not quite right, you know, he was battling over it, and how am I going to get this to work? And the model had made a suggestion, well, why don't we put me underneath or have legs coming out from underneath? And he took the suggestion, did it, and so we had these legs coming out underneath. Having those there is so vitally important to this painting, right? I mean, it's structurally interesting, right? It mirrors, goes, so you have this sort of contrapposto-esque kind of thing moving through the painting. It's like flip-flopping it. It's giving you this hidden thing underneath, so there's that mystery, like who the heck's underneath there? What are they doing? They're under the bed, you know, making me nervous. So you have that. There's also, for this painting, to me, it reminds me of The Raft of the Medusa, which is a Jericho painting, Theodore Jericho, romantic painting of sort of a shipwreck, and I'm sure you've seen images, if not the painting, or people are all sort of laid out on this wreckage of a boat wreckage on the ocean, and they're splayed out on it, and you know, lots of nefarious bad things happen, like, you know, cannibalism and stuff. Anyways, they're laid out on top of this in a somewhat similar fashion. There's something about this pose, and again, a kind of dead look on that face, I have to say it, you know, a weird look, that reminds me of that Jericho painting and that sort of splayed out almost dead or quasi-dead thing. Again, and in some ways this is slightly interesting to me, the animal dog is painted really well, but if you look at the face, especially when you're up in the distance that I am, there's almost a weird almost a look of deterioration to the face, as if the dog would be dead and slowly it's deteriorating. You're seeing through to some of the structure of the jaw or the teeth or something. And I don't know that it's present from back there or that you readily notice it, but when you come up, I think it's there. And that relationship to the weird dead quality of the figure on the top is pretty striking, I think. I don't know, man. I don't think I'd want to be one of his models. First, you have to stand or sit or pose forever. Secondly, he's going to make you look dead, you know? I mean, there's lots of, like, reasons maybe not to be his model. But I think this is a really great painting. That yellow up the top, right? That window, that's the sort of abstract, like, yellow thing. Like, brilliant. Great, great move, you know? It's such an oddity, but it also ties in the yellow to the wall and some of the coloration elsewhere in the painting. Just interesting maneuver, you know, and striking that he would go to that sort of degree of just simplifying that sort of segment and making it really, really flat. So I thought that was really great about this painting as well. It also has I forget who said it, but it has that weird tilting thing again. And this almost relates to the Raft of the Medusa too. I think that tilting of space in this case feels a bit like the Raft of the Medusa, which is sort of looms at you a bit. So there's a kind of intensity to that. There's also, for me, because of that dead quality and stuff, when things are pushed toward me, that heightens the repulsion a little bit. There's a lure to the painting, which is it's beautifully painted, and it has all these textural and beautiful things to look at, but there's a bit of a repulsion, too. So it's almost like he's, come on in, and then he's going to sucker punch you or something, you know? And I think that's also pretty interesting. Okay. All right, so let's go to this other room. Okay, so in this room I want to talk about several paintings. Firstly this one. this is another one. Actually, there's two in here that I find slightly cruel. This is one that I find kind of creepy. First of all, he has her as this kind of odalisque, you know, classical pose. I read her as a pretty young girl, teenage, early 20s, somewhere in there, okay, pretty young. So we have the whole classical, old, powerful model, male model, or male artist, and young, nubile girl. The title of the painting is Flora with Blue Toenails. I think the blue toenails... I also slightly sexualizes the piece, and so I think that sort of heightens the uncomfortable quality of it a little bit. It's beautifully painted. There's also a slightly weird look to her face. It's not quite the dead thing, but it's a far-off kind of look, you know, so it is kind of insular a little bit, but beautifully painted in terms of her body, and just some technical things of sort of how he's using the texture we talked about elsewhere. I think in this case it's actually working, how the texture is running through her body. It's not too much. And then how he's pulling these sort of large strokes for the background, so he's creating just a sort of nice visual range of the range of language within the painting is varied and interesting. The creepy thing is he's got the shadow of his head, right, which you all see, I'm sure. And so to me, that is just this weird Alfred Hitchcockian, you know, I mean, it could just be, okay, here's the model and here's my head, but it has a kind of sinister quality to me. Maybe I'm reading too much, but at least a predatory quality, right? Maybe sexually predatory. So, you know, whatever. Again, this is not necessarily a bad thing, just like the other painting that we were talking about, where there was a bit of cruelty. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It just, in fact, in some ways, it heightens the tension in the painting that we talked about. It makes this sort of psychologically complicated. But it also kind of makes us complicit. Because of her pose, we become voyeurs, but we're also stand-in for him, right? So we are a predator in some ways. And so I think that's pretty interesting, too, that he's making the viewer complicit in this relationship. So, again, pretty smart. This painting is one of the three or four that I found strangely anomalous. I'm not sure how to make it. I mean, it's still sort of technically maybe more in line than some of the other odder ones, but this sort of, again, a kind of insular pose of the children. They're not looking at us. We don't get their gaze. We do see their eyes, but they're off looking off in different directions. So it's sort of kind of like it's sort of like the loneliness of being in a crowd kind of thing. You know, you're there, but you're not really interacting. So he has that with a portrayal of children. I don't remember the children. Do you remember the story behind the children, like who they are or anything? Grandchildren. So weirder again. So there's this sort of weird distance and isolation. Then he has the ducks, which I find the most delicately and fully realized thing that he paints. Again, a kind of real attention to how those are painted. And they're, you know, this is sort of like almost jovial little duck face. And then we got Leigh Bowery in the corner, a little portrait of, which is, looks like he's been beat up for like 3 days or been drinking for like six. I mean, it's a little strange. Like, here's my grandchildren with their ducks, and here's good old menacing, weird portrait of Lay. You know, I find that sort of slightly off-putting. I mean, it could just be that's what was there. He was painting Leigh Bowery, and there's, you know, whatever. But to put that all in the context of the children and the ducks, and that, again, it creates a weird psychological content to the painting that is off-putting a little bit. It's not one of my favorite paintings because I feel like the children are I don't know how to put it exactly. I guess it's that detachment. I feel like a lot of detachment, so I'm not that intrigued in the way that he's painted them, that what he's captured in them. If painting pictures of people is about capturing something, which I'm not really sure about, but if it's supposedly about getting something about the person and making that indelible in the painting, sometimes you feel that really powerfully in some of his work. I think almost most powerfully in his self-portraits, which is sort of ironic. If you look at the self-portraits, he's amazing what he gets in those self-portraits. I mean, they are really, really masterful, I think. And they're telling, too, about him and his attitude. The one where he's looking askance, a little small one. Whoa, that's intense. I mean, that's a really great portrait. But when you get to some of these portraits, I feel like that detachment, it's not quite there. You know, it's not happening as much. This painting right behind, this, to me, is a version of the cruel thing we had before, but maybe this one is slightly more of the sinister humor. I feel like the other one of her is a bit more overtly negative, you know, and aggressive almost. This one, I actually think the way he's painted her is quite beautiful, and there is a kind of even a kind of delicacy to her pose, and you know, there's something like the touch of her feet. I mean, she's obviously a big woman, she's a heavy woman, but the touch of her feet just barely, and there's something like balletic almost about that barely touching the ground that I think is really beautiful. However, then he sticks the predatory animals on a tapestry above. So as soon as he does that, she becomes the meat. She becomes the thing that's being, you know, sought after to eat. So I think it's very hard not to make those sort of connotations or those interpretations of the work. I don't think they're the only ones, certainly, but I think that's there. And I find it, I mean, he could have put any bit of tapestry, he could have put any segment, he could have faked it, and put, if that was the actual thing, he could have put any other animal in there, but he put predatory cats, right? So there is something there. And you can say that's cruelty, you could say that's sinister humor. I think it's a little of both. There's, you know, there's a kind of dark humor there, maybe. But it's at the expense of somebody. The fact that he paints her so wonderfully, though, sort of offsets it for me. It's different than, say, that other one, where I don't feel that. There's a kind of empathy here, a little bit, for me, in the way that she's painted, that's lost in the one over there. Okay, the last thing is just I want to talk very briefly in this room, and then we'll call it, I know I'm rambling on, we'll call it quits. kind of come on in, small room. So this is kind of a small room to look at. I guess since we're sort of hovered around this one, we'll talk about this one first. But I'm not going to talk a lot about these particular paintings, just very briefly, and then I'll end. If you have any questions or whatever, we can talk. Or I'll be around to talk after. This is one where, kind of like the portrait of the woman where the face gets really textured and lost. It's obviously an unfinished painting. But I almost feel like he would have gone too far with this painting. It's like he's very close. Where he's, the image is getting lost through all that texture and it's becoming just about this sort of flatness. That being said, I also feel like maybe if he lived longer, maybe this was a window to something else. Like maybe these are slightly experimental and maybe this is his way of saying, okay, I know I've got to, I want to find something else. I'm still searching, which is, there's a hint here of like maybe there's another chapter to what his work will be. And so I find that kind of intriguing to see this half-finished painting in that light. The painting behind his self-portrait, it's actually not one of my favorite of his self-portraits, but I do think it's a good one. And I think you get a bit of that texture and the sort of intensity in his face. I love that he's putting himself, me the painter, you know, the wizened old man, but behind him is not a sort of detailed face or a figure. It's sort of just this abstract chunk of paint, you know. It's like a tighter Pollock or something, you know. And I like that. I mean, that's a setup. It's the sort of thing I'm going to create a sort of tension by making my face depictive and making what's behind me not. But I also think because it's a self-portrait, it says something, you know. It says it's an interesting choice that he's going to have that behind him because that it's standing in for him as painter, both as him the person, but the thing behind him. And so I find that pretty interesting that he made that choice in that painting. Last, I just would end with Hockney for absolutely no reason other than I love Hockney. And it's a great picture of Hockney. Actually, the one thing I want to say about Hockney in this picture is that, like many of the portraits, if you go and look at them, some of them, like the girl right around this corner, more of a standard pose almost to me. Like the face is like a little more, I don't want to say Hallmark, that's too pejorative, but it's a little more standard. Here, he gets at this point in between again. What is that expression that Hockney's making? I don't know. It's like this weird in-between. But it doesn't look like he's aping and making a strange face. It doesn't look like he's posing and saying, now I'm ready for my, you know, portrait for posterity. He's just that in-between thing. I think that mystery of that space in between, at least in the portraits, is something that Freud is really, really good at. So if you go back and look at the show, I would sort of pay attention to that. Like, this is less so. The eyes are quite interesting, but this is a little bit less so in terms of the expression. And the expressions that he gets in some of these portraits are really, really magnificent. So, yeah? It's the classic photographer thing, like, okay, I'm going to shoot you at 3, and they shoot you at 2, right? Because they don't want you to get to the point where you're posing, you know, or they shoot you at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, and we're going with number 6, right? So you're right, it is sort of like that.
Did you say this was last?
I don't know if it's his last painting, but it's an unfinished painting. So to me, there you go. So that it sort of engenders this idea that maybe something else is in the offing, you know? Well, thank you for coming. I hope you enjoyed it, and be around for questions.
Well, several, but